Our second sermon from Romans comes from chapter 1, and I'll be reading the text that is on the screen. We'll be on the screen in just a second. Please read with me. It's also in your bulletins. Chapter 1, verses 17 and 18. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God unto salvation for all who believe, for the Jew and the Gentile. What isn't that great? It's such a fascinating verse. This one, two verses together really gives us an overture to the entire book. And I'm thankful that the movie Les Miserables has come out so that you can be reminded of what an overture is, right? It's kind of one song that has elements in it that all the other songs are gonna pick up on. And really, no matter where you are in the book of Romans, the most obscure passage to the most obvious, you can find an element of it in this text. You could really preach this text for about 6 or 7 hours if you wanted to, but I won't. But you could, and it's beautiful. But what really captures me by it is how it starts. I'm not ashamed. Isn't that an odd thing to say? I was eating lunch with Bianca on Friday, and we were kicking around the idea of going out with some of her friends. And I said, well, you know what would really be fun would be to go to a karaoke bar. And then I quickly went, but I won't embarrass you, I promise. I'm sorry. And she said to me, I'm not embarrassed by your singing. Now, note what she says there, right? She does not say, I'm proud of your singing. When you say, I'm not embarrassed by it, it kind of implies that I might be. You could think that I would be, but I'm not. And that's what Paul does here. He doesn't come out and he say, I'm proud of it. He says, I'm not ashamed of it. Which implies that it would be reasonable for you to assume I would be. And I'm glad the Apostle Paul felt that way because I feel that way. Don't you? Sometimes. Sometimes aren't you tempted to be ashamed of it? You know, what was Paul like? He was a small man. And he was talking to Romans. And in that time period, you know, the word that meant power, strength, the very personification of dignity and of sophistication and of just unstoppable power was Rome. World conquerors. And here he was with his little message about a man that Rome had crucified on any other day. And he says, I'm not ashamed to say that, yes, that message is your hope. That message is what will give you life. I'm not ashamed of that message because it's the power of salvation. And I feel that. I mean, I think we're not being honest with ourselves if we don't at least give it a nod. You know, just look at the major debates of the day. I mean, when, gun controls back in the news. And would you feel just absolutely confident going and saying the gospel is the only hope to stop the violence in this country? I don't hear that message, you know, from either side of the aisle. I don't hear that one. And you're not going to. You'd be a little bit embarrassed. And Paul's saying, I'm not ashamed. And I'll tell you why I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed because the gospel is the power of God unto salvation. I'm not ashamed because in the gospel, God's righteousness is revealed. And I'm not ashamed because the gospel is the only source of life. Faith in the gospel brings life in a way that nothing else does. And that's what we're going to look at today. We're not ashamed of the gospel because it is power, because of the unveiling of God's righteousness, and because it's the source of life. First, the first reason Paul is not ashamed is because it has power. He says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation. to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and to the Greek. You know what it means to not be ashamed of something because it has power? When I was a kid, I drove my mom's car. We only had one car in our family. And it was a 1975 Caprice Classic. And I'm not that old, okay? It was 1987 when I was driving it. It was an old car. And it was nasty. You know, it had cloth seats, and the seats were all worn out, and you know, the little foam was sticking out. We had to have a bed sheet over the front seat to keep the foam from getting all over you, and the top was kind of sagging down on you. I don't know if you remember those cars. It was from the 70s, perfect, beautiful pieces of work. And there was rust around the outside of the trunk, and so every time it rained, water would run down into the trunk, and when I would stop, it would sound like a washing machine, kind of a whoosh, whoosh. I mean, it was ugly. And down the street from me lived Kevin Kelly. And for Kevin Kelly's 16th birthday, he got a fully restored and remodeled 1964 Mustang. And it was fly. And I was, you know, jealous. But I was not ashamed of my 75 Caprice Classic. And you want to know why? Because Kevin Kelly's Mustang had a 200 cubic inch engine. And my nasty 1975 Caprice had a 360 cubic engine with a four-barrel carburetor. And I could suck his paint off and spit him out the exhaust pipe. I was unashamed. I went out looking for him. And that's what Paul is saying. You don't have to be ashamed of the gospel because it's powerful. It is powerful. It changes lives. It changes people. It makes them different. It is powerful to save them. And the question that has to come back, if you understand your religion at all, is this. Save you from what? It saves you from the power of sin, so that you're no longer enslaved to it. I was talking to somebody this week who was recounting the days when his life had become one lie after another, after another. He was living a false life, and he had to lie to cover it up, and he was trying to lie to cover that up. And he was just, he said every day he woke up feeling like he was already in hell. And he couldn't escape the lies. And the gospel freed him from that. It's the power, it frees you from the power of sin, the slavery to sin. It saves you from the pollution of sin, all the shame. That knowing that the Lord of the universe loves you, that song we just sang, love divine, all love's excelling. The Lord loves you like that. The Lord of the universe loves you like that. It restores your dignity to you. When everybody else would be embarrassed by you. When you're embarrassed by yourself. I tell you who I would not be ashamed to share the gospel with today. You know, 4 years ago, Lance Armstrong said, if there's a divine judge up there, I would hope he wouldn't judge me based on whether or not I was baptized. I would hope that he would judge me based on whether or not I had lived a true life. You think he's saying that today? Of course not. He doesn't want to be judged on whether or not he's been honest, and you don't either. And thank God for the power of the gospel that frees us from the shame, and it frees us from the penalty. It frees us from the guilt. It frees us from the bitterness of looking at everybody who hasn't treated us right. It frees us from loneliness by restoring us to community. And once we're able to say, yes, I am a sinner. I am broken. I am not what I ought to be. I'm not what I should have been. Then that enables us to come into community and be received and loved. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It's the power of God unto salvation from the power of sin and from the pollution of sin and, yes, from the penalty of sin. Because Jesus has paid our debt for us. So we do not look forward to facing an angry God who is going to cast us into hell and going to exact punishment from us for every sin that we've committed. He is satisfied. He's satisfied. And I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God to save me from all that. Not only is Paul saying he's not ashamed of it because it's powerful, but it's both powerful and it has long arms. Look at this. It's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, but also to the Greek. He's saying it has long reach. When I was a kid, they used to show boxing on television. Now you have to do pay-per-view, and I don't think anybody even pays for it anymore. And I remember it was a huge match. Randall Tex Cobb against Larry Holmes. Larry Holmes was the undefeated champion of the world, and Tex Cobb was very, very tough. And he was going to be the guy who went 15 rounds with Larry Holmes. And he just thought, if I could just get close enough to him, he was so strong. He was just, you know, Tex Cobb from Raising Arizona, by the way. He was that guy on the motorcycle. He also used to hang out around Vanderbilt and eat at Perkins at 2 in the morning, but that's another story. And he just thought, you know, if he could ever hit Holmes, Holmes would finally go down. He was so strong. But the problem was this. Larry Holmes had a lot further reach. And he just used Cobb like a punching bag. And Cobb never even got close to him. And, you know, a few weeks later, you know, Larry Tex Cobb went on Johnny Carson. And Carson said, well, it looked like Larry Holmes had a little bit of a reach advantage. He said, yeah, I think I noticed that too. You know, just a punch. He couldn't do anything with it. All his power was useless because he couldn't get close. But Paul is here saying that God's grace, God's power has a long reach. It can reach anybody. It can reach anywhere. Back in the 70s, it reached into a New York ghetto through an evangelist named David Wilkerson. He went and found the leader of a gang called the Mau Maus, and he was talking to this guy who'd been abused his entire life. He was violent. Violent and mean young man, and this pastor started trying to share the gospel with him, and Nicky Cruz spit in his face and started cussing him, telling him to get out of here, and Wilkerson wouldn't leave, and Nicky Cruz started threatening him, and Wilkerson said, you could cut me into 1,000 pieces, but every one of those pieces would love you. And it awakened this desire in his heart. He didn't even know what he was desiring. But weeks later, he took his entire gang to hear David Wilkerson preach. And one by one, they all went up there. And he went up to the front and gave his life to Christ. And he wept. And for the first time in his life, he said, I love you to somebody. He said, I love you to Jesus. And he left his life in the gangs. And he went to Bible college and became a speaker traveling the country. And he came to Tennessee. And a young man went and heard him whose initials were MM. And he thought the Mau Maus were cool because their initials were MM. And so he just went to hear him because he wanted to hear these cool gang stories. But while Cruz was speaking, he started realizing that he needed a father that he didn't have. He also realized he really wanted to go speak to this cute girl down front. And she was a counselor. And so he got up and went down front, responded to the altar call so he could talk to her. But she wouldn't talk to him. She made a boy talk to him. And the boy started talking to him about God, the gospel and the fatherhood of God. And the young man gave his life to Christ. 14 years old, and back at home, that boy had a 4-year-old brother. A 4-year-old brother who unashamedly wanted to be just like him. And so when this kid started preaching at Youth Sunday every Sunday morning, his little punk brother would go home and preach to his stuffed animals. He's not preaching to stuffed animals anymore. He's preaching to you. That's the long arm of Jesus. It reached in the ghettos of New York, and it reached Nicky Cruz, and now it's reaching you. And it will continue reaching. And everybody it reaches, it touches with that power of salvation. And we don't have to be ashamed of it. We don't have to be ashamed of it because it changes whatever it touches. Secondly, we don't have to be ashamed of it because it has a secret. It has a secret. You know, in our family, we have a favorite movie. We have several favorite movies. And one of them is The Princess Bride. You can't be a Jones boy if you don't know every word to The Princess Bride. And, you know, if you haven't seen it, there's this scene. It's about this guy who's trying to go and rescue his princess. And it's a scene where he's got a mask on and he's in a sword fight. And the two are fighting each other. And he starts to say, you know, you're a better swordsman than I am. And the guy who's fighting against him says, then when are, why are you smiling? And he says, because I have a secret. I'm not left-handed. You know, and he changes hands and he wins the sword fight. We don't have to be ashamed of the gospel because it has a secret. And that secret is the righteousness of God revealed. It's the righteousness of God revealed. Now, that's a hard text to get your, to wrap your mind around. There was a German monk by the name of Martin Luther who despised that text. He said whenever he thought of the righteousness of God, the only thing he could think of was that the Lord was so holy and his eyes were so pure that he could not stand to look upon a sinner like him. And no matter what he did, he could not make himself worthy of God's even looking at him. And he said he abhorred this text until one day it finally broke through to him that the law and the gospel were two separate things and that God by his grace was making him righteous and that the righteousness of God that was revealed was this, that God was so overwhelmingly, so unexpectedly good that he would maintain his own righteousness. He would not compromise his holiness at all and yet would make unrighteous, unholy, sinful people righteous. That's what the righteousness of God means. He said the gospel broke through to him and his heart leapt and he sang for joy and his entire life was changed and through him the entire culture of Europe was changed. Because God's righteousness, this text could be read like this, because God has revealed his righteousness, that he righteously makes righteous the unrighteous. That's a terrible sentence, but I want you to memorize it. What does it mean? It means God is righteous. He keeps his word. He is faithful. He has promised to save a people for himself, to make those people holy and to spend eternity with them. And he has kept his word. He's kept his word. He hasn't left us alone. What does it mean that God is righteous? It means that he has forgiven our sin in a way that is holy. He hasn't just said, who cares? So you're bad. But he's judged sin. He has condemned sin in his son. He's condemned sin in himself. And he's punished it. He placed all of our sin upon Christ. Christ willingly took it. He took it all for us. And he punished it. Christ paid our debt. God hasn't just forgotten the debt. He's paid it for us. He's righteous in the way that he's made us righteous. And he's righteous because he's changed us. You see, we're not what we ought to be. We're not what we ought to be. When I was young, I used to do building projects every now and then for my uncle. And one time I was trying to put this wall up. I didn't know this at the time. He was just trying to keep me out of his hair. So he had me kind of putting this wall up. And at the end of the day, he dropped a plumb line. You know, a plumb line is it's just a piece of string, basically, with something heavy at the bottom, and it always hangs straight, thanks to gravity. And so he held it up at the top of the wall, right up next to the bricks, and at the bottom of the wall is about, you know, that far away from the bricks. Tells you my wall wasn't straight. I was out of plumb. But he was smart. He just took the most down. And he didn't really give me cement. He just kind of gave me sand and brushed them off. He rebuilt it himself. And that's what God's done. He's held that plumb line up to you, and he said, you arrogant, self-righteous, perfectionistic, merciless, graceless prig. You think you are straight and you judge everybody else by what you think. Look how far out of plumb you are. And he takes the wall down and he rebuilds us in Christ. All of Christ's righteousness, all of his graciousness, all of his love is put upon you. When you think of that, don't think about, yeah, Jesus never said a bad word and that's put upon me. That's more or less true. Jesus never thought about himself. His whole life was one long giving of himself to others, and that's what's put upon you. Of course you're selfish. But when Jesus, God sees you, he sees Jesus' love put upon you. He sees the wall that Jesus built. He's made you righteous. The righteousness of God is revealed. If you didn't get all that, don't worry. We're going to study it for about the next 18 months. It's called the Book of Romans. We don't have to be ashamed of the gospel because it is the power of God in the salvation. It is the righteousness of God revealed. And finally, we don't have to be ashamed of the gospel because it's the only source of life. This might be my favorite verse in all the Bible. Because it's the one I just go back to the most during counseling and all kinds of situations. He says, the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith. As it is written, the righteous shall live by faith. From faith for faith, for the righteous shall live by faith. That's frustrating. I mean, good night, Paul. We get the idea that faith is important. You say it three times, but what could that possibly mean? What could it possibly mean? From faith, for faith, the righteous shall live by faith. Well, let's just take it apart. We got about 8 minutes left, so let's take it apart. First of all, it means that you start by faith. All right, you start. You got to believe that it's true. You got to believe that these are the words of life. If you don't believe that these are the words of life, if you don't believe that the Son of God came and as a man and lived the perfect life for you and died the death that you deserve, if you don't believe that, you don't even have a place to start. It begins with faith. But then it becomes something else. It goes from faith to faith. Some translations will say faith from first to the last. From faith to faith, others will say. It goes from just believing that it happened, believing the facts, to actually entrusting yourselves to them. It means you stop trusting in yourself and you start trusting in another. The best illustration I can come up with for this has to do with me and my former life when I was a very, very cool, good-looking, don't laugh, teenager. And I did what every cool, good-looking teenager does during the summer. I was a lifeguard. Now, being a lifeguard means you're going to have, you know, just hundreds of beautiful girls looking up to you, which was true, but they were all like eight, you know. And it really was not the job that I had imagined. And it means you're going to be important and you're going to be saving lives, which is true, but they were all dumb. And what I mean by that is this. I was a lifeguard in a public pool. You're never more than 8 feet from the wall. You really should never need help. And I never had to go in during the day. We'd have 300 kids in there splashing around. Nobody ever got hurt. It was always during private parties. And what would happen would be this. The same thing happened every time. There would be a mother. I don't know why it was never a dad. It was always a mother. A mother who wanted to teach her child not to be afraid of the diving board. So she would swim out into 11 feet of water. And she would yell to her child, Johnny, jump to me. Yeah, you see where it was going, right? And so Johnny jumps right on her face. And she does what you do when someone jumps on her face. She yells, but now she's underwater. So when she yells, she's taking in water, right? And Johnny is squeezing onto her head, but she's sinking. So she's not helping him very much. So I go in, which you're not supposed to do. Supposed to reach, throw, and go, I know. But I just jump in because it's 2 feet from the wall. I think I can handle this. And I say, Johnny, grab me. And Johnny's going like this. And he realizes he's drowning. And he looks at me and he goes, oh, he's not drowning. Okay. And he grabs hold of me. And that embrace is faith. That is faith. He had to believe, first of all, that I was there, right, and then I could help him. But that wasn't the faith that saved him. What saved him was embracing me, trusting me. That is saving faith, when you're trusting the one who saves you. We go on from faith to faith. And the beauty is, and he goes on to continue by saying, as it is written, the righteous shall live by faith, which means you'll never get beyond it. You'll never get past it. There will never come a day when you don't need faith anymore. And that may sound easy. You're sitting in church going, oh, that's so sweet. That's the hardest thing in the world. Because every day, what you want more than anything else and what I want more than anything else is to stop needing Jesus. I just want to be fine. I just want to know what to do and know that if I do things right, everything's going to work out. Don't you feel that way? Just give me a book on how to raise my stinking children so I know they're all going to grow up to be perfect, godly, wealthy young men who support their father. That's what I need. I don't want faith. I don't want to have to pray for them. I don't want to have to wait and see what God does with them. I don't want to watch their hearts get broken. I don't want to watch them struggle. I don't want to have to go to them and tell them that I did it wrong and I'm sorry and you need to, you know, be aware of how I've messed you up and ask the Lord to heal that and move on. I just want to do it right. I want to live by sight. I want to live by law. And every day I come back and I look at the stuff I was so proud of yesterday and I have to say, it's unrighteous. It's not enough. And I let go of whatever it was that I was holding on to that was drowning. Every day, every day. Yesterday, I wrote a really good blog post. It was good. I write one good thing a year. It's okay for me to say that. It's an objective fact, okay? 99% of what I do and say and write is junk, throw it away. But this was good. You know what I have to do today? Let go. It's not going to get me to heaven. It's not my identity. It's not going to complete me. Lance Armstrong's not going to read it. I'm not going to be famous for it. Let go. No. No, honey. None of that's going to happen. Just let go and embrace Jesus. And I have to do it again and again. And this is the message for you, and it's the message for me. People ask sometimes, do I have altar calls? And the answer is yes. We have an altar call almost every week. We call it communion. And the reason why we do it that way is this. If you think going to the altar once and giving your life to Jesus once was enough, then you don't get it. We do it every day. And so I'm going to invite you to come up here and take the Lord's Supper and by faith eat his body and by faith drink his blood and let his righteousness and his sacrifice wash you clean. Let him tell you that he loves you and you tell him that you love him. And if this is the first time you've ever done that, praise the Lord. I'm so excited. Please come and tell me. I'm going to help you. I want to walk with you. I want to give you some good books to read and get you together with some people who can disciple you. And if this is the 10,000th time that you've done that, that is awesome. Praise the Lord. Please come tell me. Because I want to keep you walking that way too. We're all going to do this together. Please pray with me.